Today on Against the Grain, the last 3 years have been the hottest on record, but rather than urgently addressing global warming, we now have a government helmed by a climate denier who has chosen the head of ExxonMobil as his Secretary of State. So are we doomed? Left-wing environmentalist Tom Athanasiou thinks not. I'll be joined by him to hear the case he makes for the Trump backlash ushering in the best hope for aggressive action against global warming. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Scientists agree that we need to keep the global average temperature under 1.5 degrees Celsius, or 2 degrees at most, to prevent the most deleterious effects of global warming. After various other international climate summits had failed, 2 years ago, countries under the auspices of the United Nations hammered out an agreement in Paris that was hailed by many as the first attempt to reach a significant commitment on limiting greenhouse gas emissions. It was also criticized by many others for not being strong enough. Donald Trump plans to defund the Paris Accords, leaving many to wonder if global warming will now be unstoppable. Joining me to consider that question is Tom Athanasiou, who suggests all is not lost. He's a longtime left-green who used to work closely with Murray Bookchin. He's also the executive director of EcoEquity and has been involved in global climate negotiations for the past 15 years. Tom, does the election of Donald Trump mean that there's now no hope of holding the average global temperature under 2 degrees Celsius?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, there's two things to say about that. First of all, that we weren't going to make it before Donald Trump's election. And so it would be a false contrast if we assumed that we were. And the second is that I believe that there's going to be a massive backlash against Trump. And it, within the climate movement, right now, there are strategy meetings going on in which the inevitability of that backlash is being discussed. And my question is, how can we make that backlash into a slingshot in which we actually drive forward with a more aggressive transition than would otherwise have been possible?
So in other words, not just trying to put the brakes on whatever Trump has in mind, but actually something that in some significant way leaps beyond the choices of the past, either the stasis of the present or reactionary politics of the present, but also the incrementalism of the Obama years and presumably what Clinton would have done.
Well, I mean, begin with my assertion that we were not going to make 2 degrees. You know, I am not an enemy of the Obama administration or of Obama personally, not even of Hillary Clinton, though I think she was a desperately flawed candidate. I think we have to understand incrementalism and why we need it as part of the menu of transition strategies, but I think we also really need a social and political break. And I mean, I think that's the short answer to your question. This is probably a good time to bring in Paris because it is a really good example of the kind of incrementalism that the radical left, the radical wing of the progressive movement, needs to understand a lot better than it appears to understand.
Yeah. So could you actually just lay out what was the significance of the Paris Accords? Of course, leading up to it, there had been various futile attempts for countries to come together, to come to some kind of accord about slowing down the rate of global warming. What happened in Paris, and was it a sea change, or how do you assess it?
Well, I mean, the first thing I want to say about Paris is that the left critique of it has been pretty unsatisfying. But I've been attending the climate negotiations since the year 2000. I coordinated the equity working group of the Climate Action Network. I founded a project designed to make the idea of national fair shares more concrete and accessible. So I've been working the equity furrow in this particular field for a very long time. And there's a lot of people in the movement that understand the importance of inside-outside strategy. But there are also some pretty bombastic voices that say that the Conference of Parties, the COP, it actually means Conference of Polluters, right? As if the UN negotiations was like the World Trade Organization. The UN negotiations, the UN climate negotiations belong to the people of this planet. If there is hope for a multilateral governance system that we can use to keep going off the cliff, one of the places that multilateral governance system is going to evolve from is the climate negotiations. Paris, the proof, I can actually prove that Paris was a good thing. We have to defend it. Now that the turn to the hard right has taken place, now that we're after the catastrophe, it's obvious to everybody that Paris needs to be defended. I'm extremely glad that we won Paris. That said, it is not nearly strong enough. We could talk for the entire hour about the problems with Paris, but rather than doing so, what we need to talk about is the political theory behind it and the legitimate criticisms of it. And in particular, we need to talk about the idea that was in place before the Trumpian catastrophe, or as I like to put it, the election of the Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. He is a Republican. His party has to own him, right? There was the idea of the ambition mechanism by which the Paris regime was going to get stronger and stronger over time. So there's an idea there that can be unpacked as an idea of a radical reform, as opposed to some placating reform. So that's, I think, the short answer to your question. We have to defend it. The question is whether we will be able to defend it domestically, whether we'll be able to defend it internationally. The Chinese have already been very clear in stepping forward and saying that if the United States wants to walk away from Paris, they're perfectly willing to take the mantle of leadership on their own emerging shoulders, right? And so we're talking about things like an EU-Chinese alliance in defense of the Paris Accord. That's a challenge to the American left, and it's a challenge to the whole progressive movement with respect to what do progressive ideas mean in that context? How do you operationalize them? What does justice mean in this context?
Now, isn't there the danger with Paris that if the Trump administration pulls the U.S. out, that other countries, particularly oil-producing countries, may follow suit?
Yes, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. It looks like what they're going to do is attack the entire UN system rather than attacking Paris itself. And it looks like rather than leaving us in peace, the U.S. team under Trump is actually going to show up in May at the next negotiating session. So that's going to be a bit of a chaotic.
So you're saying not pull out, but what?
It looks like they're going to cut all in, or maximally to the extent that they can get away with it, cut all U.S. funding for not just the Paris Accord and the climate negotiations process, but for the entire U.N. system. They're talking about a 40% cut, I believe. This is a very bad thing, right? The good news is that Trump's going to be a one-term president, right? And we're going to make sure that happens. So strategically, you have to think about surviving the next 4 years and building new alliances going forward. But the question is, from the perspective of the climate, is how do you maintain ambition in the context of this kind of a four-year defensive battle, or is it possible to put together an offensive coalition? These are the kinds of questions that are being discussed.
So what would that look like? I mean, you're talking about sort of two different realms somehow coming together. So as you have written, there are very clear defensive battles to be fought. the Keystone XL pipeline being one of many, right? That things that Trump will do and that people have mobilized around and can mobilize again around. But then you're also talking about what for many people seems like a very remote and hard to fathom world of these global negotiations. And as you say, many people on the left have often felt like they're smoke and mirrors, sort of charades that go on with no meaning. And you're saying, actually, we also need to take them seriously, that we can't slow global warming. We can't do what needs to be done if we're not also focusing our attention on that. So how do we even think about linking those strategies? And as you say, as you've written, delay can mean defeat when it comes to the environment. There are many battles that we can fight, and if we lose, we might be able to reverse them. But with the environment, often what is lost forever. So there's this intense urgency as well. How do we think about uniting these different spheres of struggle in a way that could be effective?
Well, Sasha, what I posit kind of academically is that, first of all, the subtitle of the paper is Climate Justice as the Post-Trump Slingshot. And what I'm talking about is the fact that in the Great Reset, which we have now been forced to, what's important to remember, we did not choose this, but in the Great Reset that the progressive movement is now going to have to go through, we need to understand that climate justice has got to play a really, really significant role. And in this context, it must be said that the American climate justice movement, because we are talking in California, and California is still part of the United States, that climate justice is almost entirely understood in terms of community resistance. And my claim is that there's actually three legs on the climate justice stool: community resistance, just transitions, and global fair shares. And I've spent most of the last 15 years working on the global fair shares problem, and it's a really, really hard problem.
What does that even mean?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that even just transitions, which is a term that we know about, hasn't really been understood.
This means just transitions in the process of mitigating climate change?
Yeah, I mean, it's necessary to remind people what we have to do. I mean, one of the great things about Paris was that we agreed to these extremely ambitious temperature targets. There's a lot to say about those temperature targets, but just agreeing that it was a political victory to have all countries, even the Saudis, agree to them, right? What would it actually mean? It means something like the phasing out of the entire fossil infrastructure by 2050 or 2070 or 2100 on the outside, if you're coming down asymptotically to zero, right? It's so hard. What the climate movement is talking about is so hard, it's almost incomprehensible. Fortunately, we have the technology, and the parts of the technology we don't quite have, like distributed grid storage for a high renewable power sector, or there's other bits, you know, how we're going to run airlines, for example, right? The parts we don't have are coming online, but we also need an extremely high cooperation world. And so to answer your previous question, we can't be thinking about going back to anything like the status quo. Trump's election was a rupture in time, and we have to look forward and we have to ask ourselves fundamental questions about what a high cooperation world would be like. And those are the questions that are bound up in this notion of just transition. And then you get to the third leg of the climate justice stool, which is fair shares. And here the thing to think about is that climate is a global commons problem, right? And there's a whole fascinating literature on commons problems. But basically, they're very, very, very hard problems because you can't solve them without justice. And so that's the atmosphere. That's the atmospheric commons. It's complicated very, very difficultly by the fact that historically in this particular capitalist world which we inhabit, fossil fuel consumption has been bound up with economic development, and the only way to get ahead was by burning fossil fuels. There's one fact that people really have to understand its significance. The single event in human history that lifted more people out of poverty than any other event in human history is the Chinese manufacturing boom. And the reason why global inequality has dropped, even though inequality within key countries has massively increased, is because so many people in China were catapulted from extreme poverty to some sort of middle class existence. That happened along with a massive pulse in carbon emissions. You know, that's the challenge. I mean, the amazing thing about the climate negotiations is that you spend time with and get to know people from China and Indonesia and Africa. I have friends all over the world that I see every year. It's like having a parallel life. You know what I mean? And there's a lot of good people in the diplomatic corps. There are a lot of good people in the scientific corps. There are a lot of good people in what we call the faith-based communities, which is a little hard for me as an atheist. But, you know, it's a big world out there, and multilateralism is a huge part of the solution. The real problem at the highest level, is that we can get out of here. We can get out of this box. But to do so, we need two things. We need a really amazing technological revolution, and we need a high cooperation world. And I'm here to say the technology revolution is just about finished, right? There's a lot of people working on it, a lot of smart people working on it. Right? But the high cooperation world is a real challenge, and we may not make it because of the chaotic situation that we've been left with by, frankly, the neoliberal revolution, which is going to maybe kill us all. That's the situation we're in, and I would like people to think about the climate negotiations and the question about of fair shares as the question of how do you divide up the remaining carbon budget while at the same time establishing a high cooperation ethos in a very, very practical way, because without it, we're not going to make it.
Tom Athanasiou is my guest. He is the executive director of Equal Equity, and we're talking about, among other things, his essay, After the Catastrophe, Climate Justice as the Post-Trump Slingshot. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, so speaking then about neoliberalism, obviously this is the climate crisis. The awareness of the climate crisis took place during a particularly inauspicious moment in the history of capitalism, a time when the idea of cooperation itself, even cooperation in some very sort of bland terms, is anathema to the way the system functions. And so are you suggesting that to be able to address the climate crisis, given the urgency of the problem and the limited amount of time that we have to address it, that it's not possible within this framework? Do you think society needs to go through some kind of enormous change, or do you think that it would be possible even within the limits of neoliberalism if there was enough effort exerted both from below and on an international level?
No, I don't think we can make it within the neoliberal world. I do think that we have no choice but to make it within the capitalist world. We don't have to like it. But we're either going to stabilize the climate system within a capitalist social formation, or we're not going to stabilize the climate system at all. And so the problem of staged transition is not one that can be avoided. So in that context, we have to take the what's called the inside-outside problem very, very seriously. I'm an inside guy, but I work very closely with people on the outside. The Civil Society Equity Review Coalition that we organized before Paris included, big southern-based organizations like the Third World Network that work on the inside and the outside. And it also included peasant groups from the Philippines and many, many small CJ groups from Africa. And so it's an inside-outside coalition, and that's the nature of the case. On the neoliberalism question, this is a really super interesting question. And you know, we have to, in this conversation, nod to Naomi Klein, because she really clarified this issue for a lot of people. At the same time, she kind of tries to have it both ways. I mean, her book is called Capitalism and the Climate, right? But what she's really telling us is that we have to get rid of neoliberal capitalism, mm-hmm. right? So we have to be very clear about this. And you know, market fundamentalism, whatever you want to call it, I have more luck calling it market fundamentalism. People can understand that. Oh, this sort of snarky ethos that cooperation itself is kind of some relic of the 60s, right? And that we have to get back to this sort of Randite world. For me, that's not a problem, because I read Atlas Shrugged when I was 14, and so I'm done with that, you know? but a lot of people are still attracted to it. And but I don't think that's the what caused them to be able to take power. What caused them to be able to take power is not that there's a committed right-wing core that believes this wacky stuff. It's the fact that there's another large group of people who feels left behind and extremely insecure, both economically and culturally, because of the way that the neoliberals have rebuilt the world. And it's, you know, frankly, if I believe, as I do, that we need a high cooperation world, how could I possibly find a place for neoliberalism? And I think the theoretical challenge here is to understand the flexibility of capitalism. Could it be re-encapsulated, as Carl Polanyi said, so that we could manage it? How would it work? What's the democracy challenge? What's the challenge in terms of international trade? Blah, 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 right? So I think that what we're really up against right now is a strategic challenge, which is how to organize against it. And I think it helps to understand that neoliberalism is in crisis. And I think that's true. I mean, I can't prove neoliberalism is in crisis, but I think it is. And I think it opens up a terrific amount of political space. And the climate movement has got to move into that space, because we're talking about, like I said before, a 100% renewables transition, you know, not to get into side conversations about geoengineering or nuclear power or stuff. We're talking about decarbonization in a very big way, which means a tremendous amount of social change and social disruption. And people are already terrified. People feel quite disrupted enough already in the Rust Belt, right? And that's why everybody has gotten the memo that just transitions has to be front and center, right?
So what would that actually look like? How would a reframing of the climate emergency take place that would address the concerns of those people, in your words, who have been left behind? What would be different about how the environmental movement raised these issues, organized around these issues, blockaded around these issues, all of those things, if they were taking into account that or making central the issue of insecurity for so many people?
Well, I think the key, Sasha, is in the debate about inequality and climate change and how the two issues come together. I mean, even Thomas Piketty, who wrote Capital in the 20th century, he's talking more and more about climate, right? And which is an interesting thing that a lot of people don't know. But and there are more and more discussions in the movement and in the academic circles around the movement about inequality and justice and how do they go together. And I think that's another one of these conversations that could go on for a really long time. I think the simple thing to say is that the disaffected, mostly white, but not all white, mostly male, but not all male, working class, but not all working class people who are the swing voters, the Rust Belt voters, they never bought the just transition story that was told by the realistic politicians, which is that, you know, you'll get 2 years of job training. There's this terrible, terrible episode where they offered 50-year-old coal miners retraining as computer programmers. I mean, it's not like that. We have to ask ourselves the question, and this is particularly true because we're going into another high automation transition, which is going to lead to even more economic insecurity. We have to ask ourselves the question of whether or not something like a universal basic income has got to be part of the climate movement agenda. But that's speculative. Let's just talk about health care for all, right? It's impossible to imagine a world in which people embrace the kind of very rapid economic and infrastructural change that's going to be necessary to get onto a high renewables development path without, at the minimum, health care for all. And yet they're dismantling it. So the answer is that the climate movement and the inequality movement have to become the same movement. And that's extremely challenging. It's extremely challenging because the climate people are terrified, and for good reason. And they want to be as practical as possible, because if we don't stabilize the climate system, we're going to be locked into a storyline that does not have a happy ending, right? And we don't have that much time. Again, the good news is the technology is almost there, right? You can't say that too many times. We are not doomed, but we have to find a way of speaking for a high cooperation world in which people are not without hope for their children. I mean, it's really as simple as that.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Tom Athanasiou about the prospects for climate change under President Trump and the prospects for a renewed movement against it, energized by such a presidency. Athanasiou is the executive director of EcoEquity. You can find a link to the essay that we're discussing on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is a longtime left green. You're talking about the difficulties on multiple levels. So on the ground, in terms of protest movements, defensive movements, the need to be able to have climate activists speak directly to people around the questions of equity, around the questions of economic insecurity. And that itself already is quite a challenge, because so much of how people have organized around the environment has not been based on that in the past. And then there's the other level, which is also very difficult, which is, and also has to do with equity, which is on the global level, and having agreements and making progress on agreements where the fact that we live in a highly unequal world is central to the politics of climate change. Can you explain in more detail the kinds of approaches you think that people here and elsewhere should be supporting on the global level to do with equity, and really what issues are at stake to do with the rich countries and the poor countries?
Oh, okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because the Trumpian problem set has kind of displaced the fair shares discussion. So in the climate, in the global climate world, when you hear the word equity, what it's really about is which countries have to cut their emissions first, and what do rich countries have to do to help developing and emerging countries cut their emissions, and beyond emissions, who's going to pay to help countries adapt to climate changes that can no longer be prevented, like sea level rise, and what are we going to do about loss and damage? Loss and damage is when you can no longer even adapt. I mean, John Holdren, a famous Berkeley professor who became Obama's chief scientific advisor, liked to say that we already know the future. It's some combination of mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. Mitigation is the technological change. Adaptation is learning to live with a different planet. Suffering is loss and damage. It's all going to cost a tremendous amount. We have plenty of money. There's no question about that. We have the technology. We have the money. I mean, they have the money, but we have the money, right? And
well, they got it from us.
They got it from us in the first place, right? And before Copenhagen, the idealistic and progressive / radical wing of the movement, and I spent many years in this camp, was trying to work on ways of understanding how to give countries fair shares that they had to mitigate, right? How to calculate fair shares for individual countries. And this is a long story, but it got very, very complicated and very, very hot politically. The thing to remember, and it didn't happen, and it wasn't going to happen. And there's a couple of things to say about this. One is that the idea of emissions rights, national emissions rights, is completely wrong and completely off the table. And the reason is nobody has any emissions rights anymore, because we're already past the safe carbon budget. So there isn't anything left for people to take, right? So this, it's a tremendously challenging negotiation, and it doesn't help to think of it as being like the WTO. In fact, if you really operationalized Paris, if you really made it work, one of the things you have to do is rebuild the WTO so that it's Paris compliant. Right. So it's not a question of Paris being a stalking horse for a neoliberal regime. It's a question of whether or not the climate negotiations process can be used as a wedge to rebuild and restructure other multilateral regimes so that they're compatible with the rapid transition to a zero carbon economy we have to negotiate. And in that context, market mechanisms have a role to play, because this is capitalism, right? And the fact that you're using market mechanisms is not necessarily the same thing as being a stalking horse for the whole neoliberal ball of wax, whatever you want to call it. Copenhagen proved that the existing governance system cannot deal with this problem. It's too big a problem. And even if it was a problem that we could deal with, we can't deal with it in a world where the states are dominated by their neoliberal elites, right? So that's a pretty fine needle to thread. And what happened between Copenhagen and Paris was that people worked out an architecture that could not be blocked even by the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, but which was a quasi-treaty that allowed for a great deal of information sharing and a great deal of equity review and science review and a great deal of interchange and continued negotiation and long-term planning. You know, like Article 4 of the Paris Agreement asks, because it cannot tell, all countries to devise long-term transition plans for phasing out carbon emissions. That's something we really want to happen, right? And if we were in a different United States, we would now be having this really, really exciting and democratic debate about how to draw American emissions, including the emissions embodied in our international trade with other countries, to zero. But we're not in that world, right? So the concept to highlight in all this is, since we can't negotiate targets and timetables because we don't have a functioning governance system, what we can hope to do is establish equity reference frameworks by which observers and diplomats and negotiators and regular citizens can understand fair shares, right? And that's why I said earlier that the fair shares challenge has to become part of the core agenda of the climate justice movement. So again, a healthy, expansive, cosmopolitan climate justice movement would focus on community resistance. It would focus on an expansive, big picture view of just transition, and it would also take on the fair shares challenge.
I'm speaking with Tom Athanasiou. He is the director of EcoEquity and for the last 15 years has worked on climate negotiations. I'm Sasha Lilly and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So forgive me for bringing these questions back to strategy, although it clearly is a question close to your heart in terms of trying to think about how to put forward a politics of climate justice in the Trump years. So in terms of what you think people should do, you've talked about what you think is the essential importance of bringing in issues of equity, addressing inequality at the same time as climate, that these things can't be separate, that they need to be done together. Clearly, there are defensive battles to be fought at places like pipeline in North Dakota and so on. Those are battles we've recently seen, so we can picture those. How do you see a hopefully resurgent left? It certainly appears to be resurgent just in the last week. How do you think that emerging movement should relate to 4 years of Trump in office in terms of focusing not on places of struggle, but as, for example, as the Trump team gets set to defund the Paris Accords along with, you know, the UN?
Well, I mean, obviously the defensive battles all need to go on. And obviously we're going to go into a period where it becomes very real to people that climate is part of the menu of key struggles. I mean, it really has changed from 5 years ago. People now realize that climate is a first-tier issue. It's not a second-tier issue for anybody anymore. But people have got to think about the just transition challenge in a much more meaty way, or at least vegan meat way, solid way, right? It can't just be a little bit of transition assistance for this or that group of workers. We have to talk about the kinds of social protections that are going to be necessary for people to embrace what is going to be an extremely challenging transition, even within the United States, remembering that it's going to be easy within the United States compared to how it's going to be inside, say, Indonesia or sure. inside South Africa, right? Because we are so rich, right? And then the third challenge, and the one that we've got to get started on, is the challenge of understanding international justice as a core issue. And it really is upsetting to me that doesn't get a lot of mind space inside the climate justice movement. And I think that's going to change now. At least I really hope that's going to change. There's going to be a completely separate battle in the negotiations to protect Paris from Trump. And it's going to be tied to a larger battle to protect the UN system against the new right-wing populists. A lot depends on what happens in Europe and if Marie Le Pen wins in France. I mean, are we looking at a successful neo-fascist movement, one that would be prefigured not only by Donald J. Trump, the Republican president that we currently have today, but also by Duterte, the kind of things that are going on in the Philippines? Or are we looking at a story, or are we looking into an abyss, let me put it that way, that we're going to decide we don't want to jump into? And if so, what are we going to have to do in order to convince all the other people who are pushing behind us to get a peek into the abyss that they don't want to look at it, and maybe they want to look, but they don't want to jump into it, right? And I think that's the challenge, and I think it's clear now that that's the challenge, and so that's the way I look at it.
Is May 8th a time people should mark as a time to mobilize, and if so, tell us why?
Well, the next big date in the United States from the climate perspective is April 29th, which is the big march in Washington. In the international calendar, the next big date is the May negotiations that run for 2 weeks because Trump is going to show up. Trump's people are going to show up and that's going to be awful, right? But maybe it won't be awful. Maybe it'll feel like the San Francisco airport when we get to the bond negotiating halls, right? You know, and so we don't know how it's going to go. The intersessional meetings are relatively small. There's only about 1,000 people there, so you know, maybe 2,000. So it's not like the big, huge meeting. So it's face to face, right? And so that's going to be fun. The next big date is the end of 2018. And the reason why 2018 is such a big date is because it's what's called the facilitative dialogue, in which we being the global community, though unfortunately the wrong global community, look at the national pledges of action that have been tabled under the Paris process and see that they're completely inadequate to the temperature targets that we, again, have agreed to, and we ask ourselves what we're going to do about that. And that process of staring into the scientific abyss is going to be focused by the fact that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is going to do a special report, which is going to come out in September of 2018 on the 1.5 temperature target. And the equity issue in this context is, okay, we know the pledges are not strong enough. Whose pledges are really not strong enough, right? That's the idea. How are we going to get from recognizing that our collective action is too weak to recognizing that unless the really bad actors are forced to move, it's going to be very difficult for other parties to move. Again, the commons problem. But even the commons problem now has been overlaid by the crisis of neo-fascism or incipient neo-fascism or right populism or whatever you want to call it. We don't know. It will be terrifying if Le Pen wins on May 7th in France, because that will indicate that we're really going into the abyss. And then, you know, I don't know what it means. I mean, I'll tell you one thing. This is not the end of history.
Well, it's a relief to hear that. So lastly, then, let me finally end by asking you about the state of renewable energy in the United States. Obviously, technology by itself without politics isn't enough. On the other hand, if there isn't the technology, things would be very dire. Something has happened. Something has taken place over, it seems like the last 5 years has been particularly significant in terms of renewable energy becoming increasingly viable. Can you just end by telling us about that, the state of renewable energy in the United States, and in some cases, certainly to do with wind technology, a lot of it taking place, ironically enough, in Republican states?
So renewable energy is really a game changer. Looking into the abyss in an imaginary world where the renewable energy revolution wasn't taking place would be really, really scary. Whereas we're in a world now where the renewable revolution is taking place, and the scientists are telling us we're in very, very serious trouble. And in that context, the first thing you have to recognize is that we have a political and institutional and ideological challenge. We do not have a technical and economic challenge. And the current rate of renewables uptake is about a quarter of what it needs to be to come in at the low end, that is the bad end, of the level of ambition that's bracketed by the Paris targets. We really need we need a step change. We need to go six times faster, but 10 times would be nice.
In terms of proliferating these technologies?
In terms of the proliferating new technology. There's a lot of noise about nukes. There's a lot of noise about geoengineering. There's a very important conversation to be had about negative emissions technologies and plantations and a lot of dangers having to do with agriculture. But basically, there are problems that are exaggerated by the opponents of renewable energy that have to do with distributed grid storage, which is actually in real life a problem that's in the process of being solved. But the main thing is that it's real. And the question is, how do you get it to really phase up, not just in the United States, but globally? And here, the equity issue is by no means the only issue. The real issues have to do with path dependency and finance and lock-in and blocking coalitions and the fossil fuel cartel and the fact that humans are change averse, and the fact by nature, and the fact that the fossil cartel and its sock puppets have gotten very good at manipulating people's change aversion and denialism and a whole lot of things. But it's there. The technology is real. It's going to be fantastic. It's already fantastic. And right now we're dealing with issues like the African Renewable Energy Initiative. The Africans have just tabled a proposal that was under development, including many people from the NGO world worked on it. But AREI proposes to build 300 gigawatts of renewable energy in Africa by 2030. Question is, how is it going to get financed? Right. And we're not talking about all public finance, like, say, for example, that we needed $25 billion, right, for AREI. That doesn't have to be all public finance. We're realistic, but it has to come one way or another. And it's not going to come in a world where the American president is pulling support out of the entire UN system. this is, I think, a good place to end. The issue that connects all the realist problematics having to do with multilateralism and the crisis of neoliberalism and the role of the state in a global commons crisis, and the really abstract and big picture problems like global equity and global justice, the place they intersect is with on the finance question. And it's important to stipulate again and for the last time that we have the money. We are not doomed. Say, just as a thought experiment, say it would cost us $50 trillion to save human civilization. Would it be worth it? Of course it would. It's 8 months gross world product, right? And we don't even have to do it in 1 year. We can do it over a period of 30 years. It's nothing. It's nothing. You know, the problem is, as you well know, that 2016 was an amazing year in human history. It was the first year since, like, the Etruscans, in which the richest 1% of the human population owned more than everybody else put together. Please go read the Oxfam study on this. It's just tremendous. I'm not asking for social revolution. I'm asking for technological revolution and global social democracy. That's all I'm asking for.
Tom Athanasiou, I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the executive director of EcoEquity. He is the author of After the Catastrophe, Climate Justice as the Post-Trump Slingshot. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as links to other organizations that Tom is affiliated with. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.